You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Each week, I break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news, and I interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter at nonzero.org. Hello and welcome to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Later in this episode, I'm going to talk to Non-Zero Editor-in-Chief Robert Wright about the first 100 days of Donald Trump's second term in office, with a particular focus on foreign policy, and that will, of course, include a lot of discussion of the big news of this week, which is Trump's decision to fire his national security advisor, Michael Waltz. But before we get into that whole conversation, here are a few of the headlines that caught our attention. A $67 million fighter jet fell off a U.S. aircraft carrier and sank, apparently as the carrier was making a sharp turn in response to Houthi missile fire. On the same day, bombs from another U.S. jet hit a migrant detention facility in northern Yemen, killing at least 68 civilians and wounding many more, according to aid workers and Houthi spokespeople. The Trump administration has now struck more than 800 targets in Yemen without achieving its stated goal of stopping Houthi attacks on commercial ships in the Red Sea. Attacks the Houthis say they will end if Israel ends its war in Gaza. 54% of Americans say the United States is in a constitutional crisis, according to a new poll from YouGov and The Economist. A similar survey from Elon University found that 67% of Americans are very or somewhat concerned about a constitutional crisis, which the poll described as, quote, a situation in which the executive branch and the courts strongly disagree over their constitutional powers, and neither side backs down, end quote. In both polls, Democrats were significantly more concerned than Republicans. Pittsburgh-based Aurora Innovation launched America's first fully driverless truck route. On Sunday, an Aurora semi-truck covered the 240 miles between Dallas and Houston without a safety driver. And the truck has now logged more than 1,200 miles without anyone in the driver's seat along that route. Texas is one of only a handful of states that permit self-driving vehicles with no human occupants. The South China Morning Post reports that a Chinese company has launched an autonomous sea vessel that can reach speeds similar to a destroyer or a U.S. Navy torpedo and can rapidly dive 60 meters below the ocean surface. Lest anyone be concerned about potential arms race implications, the SCMP notes that the vessel, dubbed Blue Whale, is, quote, designated for civilian use, end quote. Though, as it happens, the Blue Whale is capable of launching research rockets and has some of the stealth capabilities of a nuclear submarine. Trump's trade war with China could increase the risk of a real war, argues Joshua Keating of Vox. Like the American oil embargo that helped push Japan to attack Pearl Harbor, U.S. efforts to isolate China economically and cut off its access to advanced microchips and other technology are felt on the receiving end in Beijing as a graver and more provocative threat to security than Washington may realize. One China expert told Keating that full economic decoupling could so dull the incentive of the rivals to work out the issues together that, quote, the only thing to prevent the U.S. and China from going to war would be fear of war itself, end quote. Despite reports that foreign tourists have been steering clear of America in response to the Trump administration's immigration policies, travel to the United States remains steady, according to the New York Times. While there was a year-over-year decrease in international travel to U.S. airports in March, that was mainly due to the mismatch between the Christian and secular calendars. Easter break, during which Europeans flocked to the U.S. for vacation, took place in April this year instead of March. North Korea confirmed for the first time its deployment of troops in Russia's Kursk region and announced plans to build a memorial for soldiers who died there. The government's statement, which seemed designed in part to justify the sacrifice to a domestic audience, depicted Ukraine as a threat to both North Korea and Russia and trumpeted the budding alliance between Pyongyang and Moscow as a source of future security. According to a report by Stimson Center analyst Rachel Min-Young Lee, awareness of the troop deployment had been growing in North Korea, even though the government had yet to acknowledge it. go now to my conversation with Non-Zero Editor-in-Chief Robert Wright about all of the biggest news from the first 100 days of Donald Trump's second term in office. You won't want to miss it. Hey, Bob, how you doing?
I'm fine. Are you Connor Eccles, the star of the new show that everyone's talking about, Non-Zero World?
Why, yes, I am. And you happen to be Robert Wright, the editor-in-chief of Non-Zero and the guest on the show that everyone is talking about, Non-Zero World. So there's a certain amount of upside there for both of us.
Yeah, but I feel I'm on like my career descent, whereas you are being catapulted into celebrity, and I'm frankly a little worried that you, at your age, you may not handle it well and will descend into a world of drugs and sex and become a less productive worker, which would be the worst part of all.
Which is a very important reason for people to keep watching this so that you can observe my descent into, I don't even know exactly, like just kind of bacchanalian excesses.
I think we could get some clicks that way. And by the way, I would encourage, as you know, most of our audience is an audio podcast audience. If there are people who haven't seen you, I encourage them to come to the Non-Zero channel on YouTube. Maybe smash a like button or two while they're here, but mainly in order to just appreciate how young you are.
Yeah, no, that would be very much appreciated, particularly the like button thing, more than the thing about appreciating my youth. But in any case, we're killing it. But I mean, the big news that maybe we want to start off with. So this is going to be a wide ranging conversation about Trump's first 100 days in office with a focus on foreign policy. But I think that the most obvious thing to start off with is the big news from this week, which is that fully a month after, quote unquote, Signal Gate, we've officially had the firing of National Security Advisor Michael Waltz and also his deputy, Alex Wong, I believe is his name. And so we're kind of seeing a bit of a clearing house at the National Security Council. So I don't know if we should maybe give a little bit more context for listeners about this extended thing, but do you have an initial reaction to that news?
Well, you know, there's a lot of speculation. A lot of people have been casting this as an ideological struggle. There was some weeks ago a purge of, you know, staffers of Waltz's on the national security staff who tended to be hawks. And in fact, the purge seems to have come at the instigation of a fervent neocon hater and generally apparently unbalanced person, Laura Loomer. Then there was the firing of several people at a comparable level at the Pentagon on Hegseth's staff who'd been thought of as restrainers. Right. Some people saw that as like a counterattack from the hawks. That's one narrative. Some people depicted that as Hegseth kind of going hog wild in searching for leakers. And I don't know. And then there is the Signalgate thing. But if that seems kind of like a strange explanation, because Waltz's complicity in that was the first thing to come out a while ago. And since then, most of the bad news has been for Hegseth, you know. It's like there was a whole second round of people we learned he had shared the war plans with. And so, like, for Waltz to only get fired now for that, I don't know. What theory do you buy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's just clearly, I think that there's sort of an institutional theory. I mean, there's clearly a battle between the hawks and the doves in the administration, to oversimplify things, right? There's people, maybe we'll call it like the Steve Witkoff wing, who are much more enthusiastic about diplomacy with America's apparent adversaries. There are, of course, on the other side, people like Michael Waltz, now fired, who are more in favor of a confrontational approach on the world stage. So there's that kind of personality clash, but there's also just this profound kind of institutional set of challenges, right? There just doesn't seem to be a process for policymaking, and it's leaving a lot of space open for these types of rivalries to play out, for us to see a lot of kind of internal attacks between people, a lot of, you know, sudden arrivals of Laura Loomer to the White House, after which we see people getting fired. So yeah, I mean, I think the biggest takeaway from all this is that there's just, and maybe it's because there's been such a personalization of foreign policy in the mind of Donald Trump, right? He's definitely attempted to kind of control everything, and there's no reason to think that, you know, the National Security Council is going to have particular influence over decisions that Trump makes in an orderly way, or the Defense Department or the State Department. And that's something that I've seen in the reporting about this too. Nahal Tusi over at Politico had something to this effect about how, you know, even before the signal leak, there were both people who were concerned about sort of the neocon proclivities of Waltz, and at the same time that felt, you know, basically he'd been disempowered in that role, that he was not, you know, there was basically no like interagency process for making policy decisions that are often, you know, especially under like Jake Sullivan with Biden, were very much going through the National Security Council.
Yeah, well, the erratic and chaotic policymaking process seems to characterize the entire spectrum of Trump policies, you know, tariffs, even Doge was kind of start and then pull back to some extent, or at least push Musk out of the limelight. And I think that's, you know, a reflection of Trump's character and is not inconsistent with what we saw the first time around. I think it's more evident now because Trump doesn't have around him as many experienced establishment types. That's the way he wanted it. You know, he wanted his people, including a lot of loyalists. And I think that permits his personality you know, cognitive tendencies such as they are to express themselves more directly and transparently. It's you know, now we should say Waltz has been made UN ambassador, but right. It's that's very clearly a demotion, and I assume that was almost a face-saving thing, or Trump's way of appeasing Waltz's supporters in this ongoing battle. It's also more evidence that if this is an ideological battle for Trump's soul, it is not resolved, right? And, I mean, I should say, look, Waltz, it's true, this hawk is no longer national security advisor, but the acting national security advisor is Marco Rubio. And, of course, lately Rubio has been talking as if, you know, he's a Trumpist on foreign policy and not the interventionist he once was, but for most of his career, he's been a neocon's neocon. And so the big question, I guess, is, was that a reflection of conviction? In which case he may be a Trojan horse and like do some kind of, you know, remain in power at National Security Council and become the first person since Kissinger to hold both jobs, you know, head the State Department, be National Security Advisor, and steer the ship toward hawkism? Or, as seems, you know, not improbable, is he really just, you know, a completely soulless opportunist who actually never had true core ideology, but was just saying the things you would say if you're a senator from Florida? That's a big question. I don't know where we're headed.
No, I don't know either. And just, I mean, who knows how quickly all this could move if there is a new person who could be designated in the coming days, or perhaps even between the time that we're taping this and the time you hear this. We're taping on Friday morning, May 2nd. But it's interesting to see some of the names coming out about potential candidates. You've got some people pitching Steve Witkoff, who is Trump's envoy to everything, I guess, would probably be the most concise way to put it. And he certainly comes from a more sort of diplomacy forward camp, insofar as he comes from a camp, because, you know, his previous experience was as a real estate developer and longtime friend of Donald Trump's. You've seen other sort of more mainstream names. Robert O'Brien, Trump's national security advisor in his first term, has come up. And he seems to have good relations kind of across the board of Republican foreign policy. One potentially controversial one that I've seen is Michael Anton, who is leading up the policy planning staff at State right now. But he I mean, he'd be controversial because he's argued at length in print that the United States should not come to the defense of Taiwan, right? That it would not be in the U.S. national interest. So that would definitely come up. But of course, the national security advisor doesn't need to be confirmed. So there, you know, Trump could just decide to put Anton in that role.
I suspect Trump would get talked out of that. He seems responsive enough to really, really powerful constituencies within the party to not completely abandon any of them. And I think the Hawks would argue in that case that, look, even if your policy is one of not coming to Taiwan's aid, you still should preserve strategic ambiguity and not say that out loud. This guy has said it out loud. That'll be the argument against him. Right. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, you know, perhaps related. I don't know what else to say about this particular matter or where we're headed. But in general, I would say what we've seen so far in foreign policy is in a way a clearer expression of what was always pretty clearly Trump's basic view that the law of the jungle should prevail. I mean, you're seeing that in his approach to domestic politics. The administration will push the envelope as far as it can. If you can't stop it, get out of its way. And on the international stage, although it was also always clear last time around that he was no big fan of international law. And you know, as you know, I don't think the Biden administration was either, or many American presidents have been. Trump's disregard for it was a little more overt, and now it's completely overt. I mean that to me is one striking thing. It's like, yeah, I may invade Panama. I mean, maybe Greenland. I mean, we may annex Canada. We're entitled to do all this stuff because we're powerful. Try and stop us. He wasn't that explicit about this kind of stuff, as I recall, last time around. He was like, yeah, if we feel like assassinating Iran's senior military commander, we will. But even there, I'm pretty sure the administration bothered to come up with a justification under international law, which would be clearly impossible with several of the things Trump has discussed doing this time around. Right. So
I'm curious. I mean, that kind of leads naturally to the big picture question. You know, what is your big picture assessment of Trump's first 100 days when it comes to foreign policy, right? And maybe, you know, is there one like policy area that really typifies why you feel that way?
I just think it increasingly looks like he is unlikely to muster, you know, the sustained coherent strategy and tactics that it takes to accomplish even the things I would like to see him accomplish, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'd like to see him end the Ukraine war. Maybe he will, but, you know, I had Anatole Levin on the podcast, and I was asking him, like, does Witkoff have even any, like, trained diplomats on his staff? He's a real estate guy. I think he's probably pretty smart and a good deal maker and has the right inclinations, but diplomacy is very complicated. You have to know from experience what kinds of things can go wrong with a deal. And you know, you've got him handling the Iran portfolio, Ukraine, zero foreign policy experience, an administration full of loyalists, not accomplished professionals in general, probably. And so I just am not sure I see it happening. Maybe I'll be surprised. You know, I have the view on Ukraine specifically that Trump actually should be doing, if he wants to get a deal fast, on terms as favorable to Ukraine as possible, which I think should be the goal, he should do what he said he'd do a couple of years ago. He said, if I'm president, I'll come up with a deal. And I'll say to Ukraine, if you don't buy it, I'll cut off the weapons. And then if Ukraine buys it, I'll say to Russia, if you don't buy it, I'll supply Ukraine with more weapons. I mean, that's actually what he should do. And he's not, he refuses to use any real leverage with Russia. So, and I don't think Russia's in any hurry for peace, so can't be super optimistic there. We'll see. I mean, maybe the tariffs are his next big challenge. I'm sure he very much wants to get a deal with some big player like the European Union to get the tariffs down with China before, the Christmas shopping season makes it clear that, Christmas presents are going to be a lot more expensive. And he needs to get a deal well before Christmas for that to happen. So we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, one observation I might add, or one, kind of thing I might put on top of the stuff about the chaos overall, is that it sort of poses a structural challenge because, fundamentally, in a chaotic way, you can start a conflict, right? You can start lobbing missiles at the Houthis. You can accept that there's a restart of the war in Gaza. But it takes this, like, really balanced and slow and careful approach to end conflicts, right? And to achieve the things like trade deals and some of those other things that we might have less criticism for if Trump were able to pull them off. But it just seems like without a more coherent process, it's just really unlikely that those could actually happen.
Yeah, I've always thought that people who say, he's really underestimated. His political intelligence is incredible. I've always thought that was gravely overstated. He has good political instincts. He can read a room. He knows how to appeal to the emotions of people, including the darkest emotions. But as a political actual strategist who anticipates the consequences of things, there's just too many cases where he gets obvious blowback and retreats in the face of it, and it was completely predictable. So, I mean, I just agree with you. I don't see the intelligence of strategy or the constancy of purpose showing up in many policy areas. In a way, I'd be happy to be surprised because a certain amount of what he purports to want to do, I'd be in favor of. But
yeah. Yeah, I'm curious to get, there's been an interesting balance on China in the first 100 days where, his actions in terms of the trade war, in terms of the tariffs, are just clearly extremely aggressive, right? Those have really frustrated China. They've created the possibility of a really sustained increase of tensions. We had an item in the Earthling this week about a piece from Joshua Keating over at Vox talking about how this could potentially, make an actual real conflict between the U.S. and China more likely. But one funny thing has been that, at least in tone, he's been much more mild than he was the first time around at a lot of points about China. And a lot of Republican China hawks are actually kind of pissed. They feel as if he is, not kind of sounding the alarm in the same way that he was the first time. It's just this, it's almost been incidental that he's been so anti-China through the tariffs, right? Because it was the one country that decided to try to stand up and fight back rather than going immediately for a deal. So it's this interesting balance where his instinct this time around seems to be to not get super aggressive with China, but then that crashes into his instinct to not back down. And it's left us in this very interesting place.
Yeah. It's true. He hasn't done a lot of condemnation of the Chinese regime. But again, you have seen what I mentioned, the spontaneous exhibition of adolescent impulse that gets him into trouble. Like when he said, when China countered his tariffs, which, by the way, can happen in the world if you slap incredibly high tariffs on a country, they may retaliate. And he said, if they don't remove the tariffs they just imposed, I'm going to impose another whatever it was, 50%. So, obviously that's not going to have the effect you purport to intend here. They're not going to back down after being publicly threatened. So you're going to have to follow through with the 50% or whatever, which I think he did. And then China, followed. And I also think that increasingly Xi Jinping just got pissed off. And although I think he's much more carefully calculating than Trump, I think another thing that happened is he just decided, you're just going to have to hit this guy with a baseball bat, man. You're just, and China started talking super tough, like Trump would say, yeah, well, we're talking with China, and China was, no, we're not talking to them, and we're not going to talk to them until they do X, Y, and Z. They have softened their tone a little lately. We may see something, but my point My point is just that even when his intentions are diplomatic, his brain tends to get in the way.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an interesting, it just is a really interesting balance with China. And this is something that I'll be very curious to see whoever the next, assuming it's not Rubio, assuming that the next national security advisor is indeed someone new, I'll be very curious to kind of dig into their past writing on China, their past thinking on China. No, I mean, not that that matters too much, because, you know, look at Rubio, he doesn't sound anything like he did all of, 200 days ago. So things can change rapidly, but yeah, that's such an X factor. But at this point, it does seem like we're, given the trade war, given that increase in tensions, and while that's happening, we're still having, clashes, for example, or near clashes between the Philippines and China and the South China Sea. We're still having all of those background tension things that are happening. There's just, I'm nervous of a crisis in the second 100 days, right? Because I don't know how he would respond.
I mean, the Middle East is a mess. It's not getting that much publicity, but First of all, we've been hitting Yemen for 6 weeks. Like more than 800 targets have been hit. More than 800 airstrikes. As everyone predicted, the Houthis aren't backing down. They never do. And lately, within the last couple of days, Hegseth has started saying, if the Houthis don't stop, Iran's going to pay the price. There's a lot of people who know more about this than I do. A lot of them have said consistently, the Houthis, of all of Iran's so-called proxies, they're the most autonomous. They would be the hardest to rein in. They're like on their own gyroscope. And the idea, I mean, in general, proxies, As a general principle, the autonomy of proxies tends to be understated. I mean, proxies always have, a relationship, with a sponsor that permits them to sometimes pursue interests that they need to pursue. But in this case, it is, it's nuts. If we start really threatening Iran with retaliation, that's a super bad idea. Meanwhile, Syria, I mean, it's amazing how much alarming stuff isn't getting that much attention. You know, there's now a new manifestation of mass sectarian violence. This time the Druze were the recipients. Israel is treating the Druze as their clients in Syria. Mm-hmm. Although a lot of the Druze are saying, we do not want to be seen as on Team Israel, because that'll just amp up the hostility toward us from other Syrians. So there was some kind of recent, I don't know how many people died, but a lot of Druze died this week. Israel continues to treat Syria as its personal playground, and strike wherever it wants. And so it's, and Gaza, I mean, this is how bad things are. We haven't even mentioned Gaza yet. This is how much bad news there is on the foreign policy front. And just to round that out, of course, if Trump would use his leverage to end the war in Gaza, the Houthi strikes would stop. The strikes on the commercial shipping were, from the beginning, made by the Houthis conditional on the continuing war. And they said, we will call these off as soon as you end the war. Trump could do it, but he'd rather kill a ton of civilians in Yemen. This week alone, they killed in a single strike around 70 civilians in Yemen. Our tax dollars at work. So,
yeah, I mean, it's stark. On Syria, I think it's worth zeroing in on that one in particular, because, I mean, what just one aspect of the kind of fact of this sort of chaotic approach of the Trump administration is that even though they have given sort of specific demands for when they would withdraw sanctions on the Syrian regime, on the Syrian government, they have still not withdrawn those sanctions. That continues to be an issue. And we're seeing Syria now, 6 months after the fall of Assad, really, really, really struggling to get back on its feet, because it's still under these, extraordinary sanctions from the international community. There is just no way for the country to reconstruct or to deal with all of these internal challenges when it's you know, not able to import anything, hardly able to even accept aid from other countries in the region. And on top of that, it's getting bombed by Israeli warplanes. And Israel continues to, you know, you mentioned that they claim this special relationship with the Druze, which of course goes back to, you know, all the way to the 1967 war and the, you know, Israeli seizure of the Golan Heights and the area around it, which contains a large number of Druze people. And there's also many Druze within within Israel proper. But now they're arguing that, you know, Israel doesn't want to allow the Syrian army to advance basically south of Damascus, right? All of which is a fairly Druze focused area. And this is just an area that the Trump administration, if it was serious about seeking stability in the Middle East, would be putting its foot down on, right? These are the types of things that they could easily be saying, hey, we have soldiers in Syria who we do not want to potentially be targets of attacks from frustration here. We have lots of assets in the region that we do not want to be in the line of fire. And you got to stop attacking this government because it's just going to make another enemy.
Right. But at the same time, what Israel's doing is just, you know, completely disregarding international law and say this chunk of Syrian territory, we're going to basically consider our own and we may expand that. That's so consistent with Trump's way of operating generally, the complete disregard for rules, that, you know, it gets a little easier for Israel to get by with it. Now, would the Biden administration actually stop that? Probably not. They would probably make disapproving noises, and I don't know if that's better or worse. But Trump, you know, his whole way of operating just kind of loosens up the norms for everyone, I think.
Right. No, I think that's very much true. I'm trying to think of other, while we're on the Middle East. How are you feeling about the way in which obviously we've continued to see, you know, tensions with Iran, especially over the Houthis, but how are you evaluating the progress of the talks for a potential new nuclear deal?
Oh, man, that's hard to say. You know, Witkoff, at one point, I heard him saying what I thought was exactly the right thing. I mean, first of all, traditionally, you know, the sticking point, I think even to some extent with Biden, who was never in any hurry to resurrect the Obama nuclear deal or anything like it, which Trump had, of course, pulled the U.S. out of, even though Iran had complied with it. The issue had been, there was always a faction in the U.S. and U.S. politics that wanted, longer and stronger. By stronger, what they meant was they wanted ballistic missiles to be included, for example. Leave aside, not nuclear, but, you know, the deal itself was going to rule out nuclear warheads, but they just wanted to strip Iran of its ballistic missile capacity in general. And I think that kind of thing is still on the agenda of some people. It's kind of ridiculous now because Iran is so weakened for many reasons. And one of them is that the exchanges with Israel over the last couple of years, I think, demonstrated, and this is certainly conventionally said, that their ballistic missile deterrent is just not very strong anyway. It doesn't actually they would fire like a decent chunk of their arsenal. And of course, on the one hand, they weren't trying to kill a bunch of people. They weren't like lobbing them into cities and stuff. They were trying to hit military bases. But even so, their strike rate was not that high, largely because of the missile defenses. So it's, you just can't argue that, you certainly can't argue that these missiles give Iran any kind of offensive capability that Israel needs to worry about. And I don't think they give it much in the way of a deterrence. I mean, you know, remember, the deterrence once was Hezbollah, Hamas, the fact that they could ship arms via Syria to Hezbollah. Right. All those things are, you know, pretty much no longer operative in the near term. So there's really no need to, cater to Israel's desire for this to weaken, for any deal to weaken Iran as much as possible. And I have heard Witkoff talking as if he agrees with me at one point, at least. He was just saying, and I thought he was doing it kind of cleverly. He was saying, he was like acting, you know, really macho about it and saying, we will not let Iran enrich uranium beyond 3.whatever%, which I think is another way of saying we're going to return to the Obama deal and we're going to let them keep enriching uranium, which is another thing Israel opposes. Right. So he was basically, and he wasn't talking about missiles that time at least. And so at that point, he was suggesting a very reasonable deal. And I thought doing a good job of framing it politically as if we were being tough, you know, which is the way you want to sell things.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And what's interesting too, is I actually think that we've started to see a little bit of softening among more hawkish Republicans on Iran. There was, I forget the exact, there was a quote from Tom Cotton this week, who is like uber hawk on all things, where he seemed to be saying that he was hoping for a deal in which, it was just the higher levels of enrichment that were ended and not these, like you said, it's 3.25% or whatever that allows you to do civilian nuclear. And that is a crazy change. Like if Trump can force the hawks in the party to accept what is essentially the Iran nuclear deal all over again, I mean, that would be a really remarkable shift.
Yeah, if the Tom Cottons of the world are not demanding like ballistic missile concessions or the complete ending of the civilian nuclear program, I don't quite understand why we don't have a deal. I'm sure there will be arguments about how long the deal lasts, and I would assume you can extend it much further than it was going to expire. The original deal was going to expire or kind of be phased out by I don't know when, but I'm sure at this point.
Right around now, actually, this year.
Yeah. Which, you know, that was one complaint about it. But obviously, the idea is that if during the deal, you do what you should do, which is use it to improve relations with Iran, do more and more commercial engagement. In the course of that, you have enough carrots to keep offering that you just renegotiate a new deal and you extend it. Like that's possible. But that was not the path pursued.
No, certainly not. Do we have anything else to say? I mean, we've talked so much on the show over the past couple of years about Gaza, and certainly over the past couple of months as well during Trump's term. I think, my main takeaway from Trump's approach to Gaza in particular is just that he really oversold his desire to have that war end. I think I've actually been kind of surprised the extent to which he seems to just not care about the resumption of that war, because it doesn't look good, right? We're continuing to see, I don't know if people care very much about it these days, you're hearing less about it, but we're continuing to see tons of civilian casualties. There hasn't been a drop of aid that has entered the strip in the past full month, which Israel has said clearly is an attempt to place pressure on Hamas to accept, I'm not even sure what deal at this point. We've just seen him kind of go from seeming to sincerely critique the Biden administration's approach and even managing to get a real ceasefire deal that lasted for some amount of time to kind of just rolling over.
Yeah. And as I mentioned, because the Gaza war has not ended, we are in this conflict with the Houthis that only this week led not only to us killing a bunch of civilians, but, you know, an aircraft carrier making a turn apparently in response to Houthi missile fire. Saw a, what was it, $67 million fighter jet fall into the ocean and sink. But that's not the worst of it. The worst of it is it could lead to war with Iran. It could lead to any number of things as fighting goes on. And war with Iran is one of them. And Trump could end the war in Gaza. I mean, this is just criminal. And you're right. I was a little hopeful at the beginning, like you, that once he was claiming credit for that ceasefire, right? Remember, right as he came into office, he was like, hey, I did this ceasefire. And Biden was like, no, I did this ceasefire. I was like, give Trump credit. Let him own it. So then he will feel that he wants to sustain this legacy, but he didn't. Yeah. And he just starts shooting off his mouth about what would amount to ethnic cleansing and building a fucking hotel in Gaza. I mean, why do I even bother to get excited anymore? What worries me is, like, there are young people, maybe a little younger than you, who came of political consciousness more or less in 2016. And what they've seen is Trump round one, Biden, this guy who, should have been in a nursing home for at least the last 2 years of the administration, and not doing much of anything, I think, on the foreign stage that we should have been especially proud of. And now Trump, and they think this is the way politics is supposed to work. I mean, I worry that young people, that this is like being normalized. I mean, especially the Trump part, just the crudeness, the degradation of discourse, it's really bad for people to come of age thinking this is normal.
No, and it certainly is. My cards on the table. Today's actually, fun fact, my birthday. I just turned 27, so I...
Hey, happy birthday.
Thank you.
What are you going to do?
Just doing nothing too special. We're going to get some dinner tonight at a nice restaurant here in D.C.
I think you're concealing something from us. Because, I mean, now that you are a celebrity, you could just show up at any wild, like, nightclub in D.C., and just jump the velvet rope, and they're like, Mr.
At the private jet. Yeah, I had a bit more of a party weekend last weekend, because there's, I don't know if people know this about D.C., but the White House Correspondents' Dinner, like, weekend is kind of D.C. prom, so we went to a few events around that, including one at the Swiss Embassy that was very, very fun, a little bit more clubby than you might expect the Swiss Embassy to be, so maybe we'll call that the celebration. But
that was your birthday party.
Yeah, we'll call it that. Yeah, I like to think of that as my birthday party. That's right. But just speaking to the youth thing, I mean, the first election I got to vote in was 2016, right? So that was the first, it's been Trump on the scene. My political memories involve a lot of Obama. I come from a conservative place in Western Pennsylvania, so the general take was very anti-Obama, and people were pretty virulently angry about all of that. For people of my generation, and I'm sort of at the top end, at the older end of Gen Z, it's just Trump is politics, right? There's going to be 12 full years in which Trump dominated American politics. And there's just simply no way around that. And it's kind of hard to see a way that, the left and Democrats and whoever, just anyone that doesn't like Trump, can respond to that without sort of stooping down to that. Like, I see it pretty hard to, it's a genie that's hard to put back in the bottle.
Well, and there's Elon Musk on social media, our social media role model, just endorsing and spreading crazy, untrue shit and being a total jerk, and just vulgar even by my standards. And Connor, I'm not the choir boy you are.
Choir boy. Yeah, I didn't even. I feel like we're giving an interesting impression to readers. To listeners rather. I'm a choir boy. I'm young.
Wait. I have a question.
Go ahead.
Are there altar boys in the Catholic Church?
There are altar boys in the Catholic.
Were you an actual altar boy?
I was not an actual altar boy when I was a kid. No, though my sister was in the choir. So, but I was not. I was
partial
not
credit.
Boy.
Yeah. Okay.
we do get a little credit. Yeah. I mean, honestly, it's kind of funny. Listeners probably know that I'm Catholic. I'm a practicing Catholic. But my family is less. I mean, my religion comes by way of my mom. My family's actually much less religious than me. My mom is also religious, but both my dad and sister are certainly atheists. So it was kind of an interesting mix. We were not necessarily the poster child family for the local Catholic Church.
Okay. Times were simpler when I was young. Like, pretty much everyone I was aware of was religious. That was partly a result of my demographic circumstance, but it was also a different time.
Right.
So I don't know. I'm feeling really great about the world.
Yeah, let's see. What have we not hit? So we talked about Syria. We haven't really talked about Ukraine, but I thought we could kind of leave that. I mean, one foreign policy thing, pseudo foreign policy thing that's been interesting is that
this was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.